Extraneous, where we goof off and talk about really cool stories in a really deep way.
Mm-hmm. That's what we do. I'm Will.
I'm Melissa. And this week we're getting into episode 3 of the second season of His Dark Materials, The Subtle Knife.
Mm-hmm.
Really good. We're really enjoying this season very much. Like, very much, y'all.
Oh, we're just going to have to accept it. But it's a good season.
It's really good.
It's really good. It's really engaging. And we're seeing things that's just a delight to see on screen, to see some of the things that happen between the pages. I didn't think we got enough of that season one. And with any adaptation, you're never really sure if that's going to happen, or if it does happen, it's going to be good, or it's going to be engaging. But man, I've really been thrilled with just being in this world more.
Yeah, it's. I never want the episodes to end. All right, so before we do anything else, listen, if you don't get your orders in by December 1st, you may not get your stuff in time for the holidays if you order it from mischiefmerch.com.
That's right. If you want the Jordan College sweater, if you want the Will and Lyra and York and Serafina. Yeah.
The Stay Extra shirt. If you don't have a Stay Extra shirt, what's happening?
What are you doing?
What are you doing, y'all?
Do you even love the people in your life if you're not getting them a Stay Extra shirt?
You need to encourage everybody in your life to stay extra, and you can do that with a shirt.
Mm-hmm.
But seriously, there's so much fun stuff. Do you know, we've been rewatching The West Wing more, and basically what we're saying is that you can get yourself a Lyman's Muffins and Bagels mug.
Yep, you can.
You can get a I'm So Sick of Congress, I Could Vomit hat.
Mm-hmm.
All of it at mischiefmerch.com. So remember, go to mischiefmerch.com for all of your geeky needs this holiday season. Also, you can get $5 off your purchase for anything from the Mischief Media line by using the code STAYEXTRA. Again, you can pick something out of the podcast line by going to mischiefmerch.com/podcasts and enter the code STAYEXTRA.
Hey gang, so we've realized that we hadn't really talked about who all is directing and writing these episodes. It is not solely Jack Thorne the way it was for season one, or series one, as you Brits know it. In fact, it's like a whole brigade of, seem to be like really cool, young, upcoming female writers.
Yeah, a bunch of women are co-writing. We noticed after we watched season one that it felt just materially different. And we sort of looked at each other like, this doesn't writing-wise feel the same.
Yeah.
And then we started paying attention. We should have been paying attention from the jump. And it looks like they have brought in some cool, young, diverse talent.
There's a little more like life to it. There's a little more space for it to breathe. The moments of drama, I think, are a little sharper. The writers in question are Francesca Gardner, Sarah Quintrell, Lydia Adetunji, and Namsi Khan. Mm-hmm. The episode that we are looking at today was written by Sarah Quintrell. She has also done a miniseries called Ellen that won a bunch of awards in the UK. She also did a miniseries called The Trial, a murder in the family. And she acted too. She has a bunch of London stage credits, and she has been in Carrie and Barry, Rillington Place, Call the Midwife, Doctor Who.
It's very exciting, especially with Mary Malone and all that she represents. Mm-hmm. Very good.
Yeah, I agree. There's a skepticism and like a sort of like wry disregard in Mary's personality and her writing that I really appreciate.
A wry disregard.
Yeah. She's kind of over all the various men that she has to deal with over the episodes that we've seen. Yeah. And so one other thing I'd add about this group of writers is, as I was kind of Googling around, figuring out all they've done, there's a bunch of write-ups of them. None of them have done really anything that we've seen for the most part. But there's a lot of terms like up and coming, like next generation of British writers, like the hot latest thing. And so that's pretty cool to see them getting chances on what is, you know, as we understand it, especially in the UK, such a very high profile and successful show.
All right. Episode 3 opens with Ruta and Serafina without their shoes, walking through their burnt remains of their ancestral lands. Hey, remember when last week we said that we were trying to find a influencer that Ruta could be based on, the same way that we have all the goop stuff for Serafina?
Right.
Well, we got an email I love when we get email. I love it so much.
Did we get an email about this?
We did. I'm very excited to read it to you. Ella wrote us and she says, hey, friends. So I definitely think that Ruta Scotti is the opposite of Serafina Pecola's goop, moonlight, kissing your skin vibe. I'm thinking the Serena Williams Instagrammer, a beautiful bad bee, the queen he needs but don't deserve. She's very take charge.
Yeah.
And will win.
Mm-hmm. Overpowering. Does that make Serafina Maria Sharapova? Ooh. The like the fake rivalry that they tried to make a rivalry?
Did they really try to gin a rivalry out of that?
Well, yeah, because but like Serena just wiped the floor with her for a decade.
It's like, you know,
it's like LeBron versus Kevin Durant or something. Like Kevin Durant would be the best in the world if LeBron didn't exist.
That feels right. That feels more right. Anyway, thank you, Ella. Anybody else wants to send us spicy takes? It is extraneouspod@gmail.com. So anyway, back to the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, I love that. I love when we get emails.
Me too. We have another one about Oxford that we're going to just make an Instagram or tweet thread about because it's just too long to go into on the actual pod. But it's awesome. And I want to give a shout out to Michael Beattie who sent us this. And you should all look at our socials, extraneous.pod on Insta, extraneouspod on Twitter. And you'll this week, I'll write that up.
Cool. So we open with Ruta and Serafina wandering through the wastes of what I guess is Lake Inara. They're like sacred island.
It looks like the damage was done to Ruta Scotti's island. And this inspires Serafina to address the Lake Inara witches and say, we should come to... I could be wrong.
That is an interesting point. The way I had interpreted it is this was the sort of neutral, sacred location of their witch's moot.
All the witches.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So it's like, it's not any one place. So I guess it's not Lake Inara and it's not Latvia, which is where Ruta is from. It's right. It's somewhere in the north.
Yeah. It is a little confusing because you hear, and I guess you don't really need to be very specific on the show about this, but you do hear... Serafina talking about Lake Inara. And if you didn't know the books or you didn't know them well, it would give the indication that Ruta Scotti has to do with Lake Inara when she is a queen of her own land. They're close to each other, but it is her own. It's like little fiefdoms. It's a little confusing, but it's not that big of a deal.
I feel like Philip Pullman's world is a bit condensed.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's like when you're in a video game world and, you know, you're playing Fallout and you're walking through Boston and you can walk from Boston to Salem in like 6 minutes.
Right.
There's just literally no way to do that in the real world.
Yeah. It's about a 90-minute drive.
Yeah, exactly. You'd be walking for a day or something like that. So yeah, it's like it's got that feel. It's all just a little bit smaller, but it's supposed to be Earth. It's supposed to be the same.
Yeah, so we don't really get much more of the witches here. This is not really a witchy episode.
It's not. They talk about they're on the same side now. They must, you know, there's no more fighting. They must find Lyra before anyone else does. You had remarked that it looks like a 90s music video.
Big 90s music video. Yeah, vibes. Less Florence, more like...
That palette, that like gray, gray purple palette.
The grayed out palette. Or like a Soundgarden video or something.
So many music references for them. Right. So we don't get more witch stuff, but we do get the fancy goose.
Oh, man. This scene, I feel like this is fan service to me specifically.
Us. Like
to us specifically.
Thank you, writers, for listening to Extraneous. Clearly, no. It was very, very exciting to see the fancy goose of exposition not only talk, but do his expositioning.
Yeah, to Yorick Bernison.
Oh, Yorick. And he's like shaggier a little. He's a little more sallow. Mm-hmm. His bears are going hungry because Azriel totally screwed up the whole world.
I really liked this scene. I liked the bears wearing their damn armor. One weird thing I liked about this scene, I like the idea of Yorick as one of the important individuals in this world that like he can talk about Azriel and Lyra and Serafina on like an equal footing. Like in Lord of the Rings when like Elrond and Gandalf and Galadriel would all talk.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like these are the people who matter. This is like the great personages that will guide, you know, existence. And to see Yorick consulted like that, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just really liked it.
He's one of the council.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I guess they all want Azriel to be on the council, but he sort of
He's doing his own thing.
He's doing his own thing.
Yeah. Like everyone else is kind of like second tier in the story. And that's why, you know, I think what happens to Lee kind of has to happen to him. And I would put Grumman in that list too. Like Grumman is of a different level than Grumman. Lee Scoresby.
So another key thing about this scene, for people who were afraid to make the goose speak last season, doing a great job.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. He's doing fine. I feel no weirdness about him speaking.
No, I'm totally over it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he fills Yorick in on these big key things that Serafina says in book one, which is she's to bring the end of destiny. She must do it in ignorance. If she's told what she will do, it will all fail. And then he says how we are all subjects to the fates, but we must play as though we're not. These are like landmark Serafina Pecola lines, and they're given to her demon, which is great. And it's just like a nod that there are some things that they didn't quite lay out in season one fully correctly. And they're really trying to like lay the groundwork here. It's very cool. Two seasons for Amber Spyglass. Two seasons for Amber Spyglass. You're never going to do it in one. I don't care if it's if it's 15 episodes long, maybe. Two seasons for Amber Spyglass.
Mm-hmm. Manifest it.
All right, so that's Yorick, Lee, and Hester.
We cut to the balloon. We cut to your friends and mine, Lee and Hester.
We should note that they're on the way to where they are because we do get this one shot of
of
John Parry, like sort of like crypt keeper esque with his hood, and he's got Lee Scoresby's ring, and he's like, "Return, come to me, come to me." It's very It reminded me a little bit of the Wicked Witch of the West and Whisper Fox.
Yeah.
Come to me, my pretty. You know, he's doing his vibe. He's got like tattoos on his fingers.
His look is very Assassin's Creed.
That's what leads us to Lee and Hester's story, where Lee and Hester are traveling and their wind shifts.
And so they just kind of wind up. Apparently, they didn't have any specific destination, but they wind up in the small frontier city of Yenisei in Russia-ish.
Russia-ish.
Yeah. Nova Zembla, Russia-ish.
Nova Zembla, which is a real place.
Yes, it is. It's an island.
What do you think the Yenisei sort of has a parallel to?
I always thought of it as sort of the Yangtze, but it's way too far west for that.
Pro tip with all this stuff, if you're listening and you're curious about if a destination exists, you just Google it. Oftentimes it's either there or it's very close.
It's there.
Oh, really?
It's exactly there. It's the Yenisei River in Russia.
Everybody's covering ground.
Yeah, everyone's flying.
Flying real fast. That balloon is trucking. Anyway, so he decides to go up the Yenisei. Oh, no, he goes to Yenisei. It's a town as well as a river. Mm-hmm. And this is where he starts asking around about John Parry or about Stanislaus Grumman, where he goes to the Samirsky Hotel.
My spot, the Samirsky Hotel.
Do you feel like the Samirsky is a little bit too metropolitan for this town?
Yes. Well, I feel like this version of the Samirsky, the Samirsky we get on screen is a little cleaner, a little bigger, a little nicer.
It's like putting a fancy hotel in the middle of Deadwood.
Yes, I agree.
It has that feeling of like, how is this hotel real? You know,
it's not. I guess I always pictured it as looking closer to Trollsund, of like really just kind of a room where they serve alcohol. And you get a bunch of like real rough, crazy folks in there, sort of coming in and out of the wilderness.
Yeah. I like this like trading post. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I don't mind it, but it is a lot more nice. It's got like carpets and stuff.
In my head canon, they imagined Yenisei as this great influx of trade and this was going to be a much bigger town. And so they had grand designs. They built this hotel and Yenisei sort of didn't become that. So you have this sort of not fully realized hotel that is like made of wood and is very basic looking, but could have been grand.
Yeah, I feel that. I definitely get that. It's like a post-Gold Rush town.
Yes.
Yeah.
Deadwood. So anyway, we get to the Samirsky Hotel, one of our most looked forward to locations. And Lee, you know, lovely, love Lynn, lovely, not the world's most subtle investigator. Shouting Stanislaus Grumman's name in the middle of a hotel, loudly talking about somebody he knows is one of the most wanted and dangerous people in the world. Good job. Full head to toe leather in the middle of Russia.
The cherry red leather, 1.5 seasons in, like you said, it's a little much.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out why some of the Lee scenes were rubbing me a little bit weirdly. And I figured it out. It's the leather. It's too little too much leather. Mm-hmm. This is just like a little too shiny. He's a little too shiny for his environment.
Yeah, he's wearing like jewel tones, which is not how I pictured Lee Scoresby.
And I like that he's got an outsider vibe. And maybe that's exactly what they're going for. But it does feel a little bit weird in this, like, these are towns I could have built in Fallout. And he just looks a little bit polished, which, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, keep the outer coat and just give him, like, a nice flannel on the inside.
Yeah, he has a work shirt underneath, but it's very little of his outfit.
Leather on leather on leather. It's just not.
Leather on leather on leather.
Yeah, but so he does do it. He does ask about Grumman after he gets a really long story.
That he definitely didn't want from this guy.
Do you think he feels like... Like he thought he was safe here. Like there was a time when he used to be safe. Cause at the end of his scene before he gets captured, he does that thing where it's like, is there nowhere that the Magisterium
maybe
can reach?
Maybe he just doesn't perceive. Yeah. He might just think it's so out of reach and he has underestimated his enemy. Mm-hmm. Also underestimated a redheaded witch with the spider demon.
Oh my God.
In a book should be a flashing red light to not trust, whether that's right or not. But like, come on, Lee. Little bit of the art of the thing.
Yeah, exactly. You'd think that he would have a little bit more awareness. Because like, yeah, go up to the place, but just be a little more aware.
Artful.
Yeah.
You're from Texas. You got some art in you. It's all right. He goes stomping out of the place. Listen, he's got to get caught. That's the whole purpose, right?
Right. That's the point. He goes up to this observatory. Super cool. Gorgeous. The like framing shot of him like walking up to it with it on the far right of the screen is a gorgeous shot.
Yeah.
It's like well done too.
Yeah. That CGI is some beautiful work. So our observatory master is some rando with a lemur demon.
Yeah, Momo. Lemur demon. Guy looks like Jeremy Irons.
He does.
Big time.
He definitely
does. I thought
he
was for a second.
Yeah.
He's not. But, you know, poor man's Jeremy Irons and his awesome lemur demon.
We always talk about how the demons raise the stakes, that everybody who's an enemy, people who you're supposed to hate, you end up really feeling for because of this demon relationship. And when Lee shoots this guy, soon we see the demon and the demon is curled up against him, sad, like realizing he's about to lose his partner, his friend. I hope it's intentional. I hope they're trying to set up the stakes because when what happens in book three happens, that's going to be powerful if we are made to feel the loss of demons even more. And I think they're doing a lot to show us that this season already.
Bible quote, by the way, we looked it up and you were right. You predicted this. First half is correct. It's real. It's from Sermon on the Mount, I believe. It's from Matthew. Mm-hmm. Matthew 7.
First part being by their fruits shall you know them. Yep. Some variation of that is correct.
Second part is made up.
Because that's the magisterium that when we hear Asriel talking about Bible quotes at the end of the first book, it's all real Genesis stuff and then twisted. Then it's got a little extra stuff for the demons and for the magisterium. So the part that they made up was by their questions, shall you see the serpent gnawing at their heart, which is again, the magisterium seeding this idea that knowledge, questions, free will are bad and to be stomped out and are the indicia of the enemy.
So I want to get your opinion on something in this at the end of this scene. Mm-hmm. So the guy starts shooting at Lee. Lee falls down. He draws his six shooter. He fires kind of blindly. Turns out he kills the guy. Are they leaning a little too hard into the like, I'm Lee Scoresby, I hate killing people thing?
A little. I was surprised at how shot. I mean, he was in self-defense.
Yeah, the whole gunfight is really weird and like.
Right.
Save money.
He was standing in the doorway. There was a, you know, he was like taking up the doorway. He was sort of an easy shot. It was really surprising they didn't get hit, but okay.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit, I mean, Lee has definitely killed people in self-defense before. Mm-hmm. And so,
I mean, he fought in a war.
Yeah. But again, maybe what they're doing again is setting up just how hard it's going to be at the end of the season.
I would have loved to have seen like a little more nuance and subtlety in that, you know, not have him just be like, really upset and have a whole conversation with Hester about like, I don't like killing people. Well, you had to kill this person. Yeah, but I hate killing people. It's like, we get it. We get it.
But it is nice to see. I love any interaction between Lee and Hester.
It
gives my heart good things.
In general, I think we're happy with the
so Lee much Scoresby more
in this.
So much more. They've really toned him down a little bit.
Yeah.
even with the full-on leather. he is, and toned down his dialogue, not him. He's still Lee, but the dialogue is a little bit less hit trite. Over the head, a little trite last season. Sorry. Listen, we applaud a better season.
So Lee walks out of the observatory and is taken prisoner by a whole troop of soldiers.
Who clearly followed him out of the Smirsky Hotel after he stomped loudly, swished his coat around himself in basically a red blinking light of, I am a suspicious person, you should follow me. So can't really blame the Magisterium for finding him.
Meanwhile, or I guess a few hours later, turns out completely randomly.
This was bizarre. So Mrs. Coulter ends up in town. Like her Zeppelin fails or something.
Yeah, her car breaks down, essentially. Basically. And she's like, oh, I guess I'll stay here.
The mother of all meat cutes right now.
Right. And I found the idea of like Mrs. Coulter being upset that place they're staying wasn't up to her standards and everyone being like afraid to tell her that. Mm-hmm. A little out of character for the character in the book. The character in the book, it's like she is super refined and she's beautiful and she's like
an explorer.
Charming. Yeah, exactly. That like she herself... I guess what I'm trying to say is Mrs. Coulter in the book would understand the social advantage of being seen as someone who is rugged and won't complain. Some real small and large differences between the Mrs. Coulter of the
show. I mean,
this
whole thing is completely, it's not just a scene that doesn't happen in the books, like that we don't see in the books. This does not happen. Lee does not meet Mrs. Coulter in this way.
Yeah.
I don't think he meets her at all, if I'm thinking.
No, never. Yeah.
So this whole thing where they have a confrontation and there are similarities between them and you get this long, you get history of Lee, we get confirmation of a lot of what we think about Mrs. Coulter, about how she was abused. It's remarkable. I've never thought to compare Lee and Mrs. Coulter before, but when you think about it, the way Lee feels parental toward Lyra and the way Mrs. Coulter feels parental towards Lyra are at odds, and he gets to say a lot of important things. So we're skipping the part where she like comes into his cell because Red Spider Woman was like, oh, we caught an aeronaut. It's like, okay, thanks,
right.
Red Spider Woman.
And also it like begs the question, how would Mrs. Coulter know to look for an aeronaut?
She wasn't looking for it. Like the Red Spider Woman was just like, yeah, we caught an aeronaut. And she was just like, oh, you're right.
She's like, oh, an aeronaut?
Well, both anchor.
That's true. I guess, yeah, because that was, but it was like in the heat of the battle. Right.
But she would have seen him flying. She would have known kind of the report of who, she even says like, I know who you are. You know? He keeps saying his life is worth 1/10 of Lyra's. But he also gets to say this important thing like, he knows she loves Lyra, but that's not enough. It's not enough. It doesn't mean you won't hurt her. It doesn't mean she's safe with you. It doesn't work that way. And then we get this whole history of Lee being abused.
Yeah, this is a really interesting addition. I get, like you said, doesn't exist in the book. This is not in any way that we're aware of part of Lee's backstory in the book. We don't have any. I guess we have like the one memory in Alamo Gulch that seems to be a pretty happy memory.
Yep. They might have made this up as a way of further explaining why he suddenly feels so parental and protective toward her, which was very sudden in the first season. It's sudden in the book, too, but it's a little more subtle in the way it's expressed.
Yeah.
And to further elucidate what's going on with Mrs. Coulter, because they're setting up her arc. So I was like, as it was happening, it was, oh, what's happening? Why is this happening? What's happening? Why is this happening? But the more I think about it, the more I like it.
It's just, it's different, but I think it's really compelling stuff. And it totally works for the world of the TV series.
It's a very, he's definitely hinting towards physical abuse. I was really more guessing emotional and sexual abuse with her.
I was too. And it is a little different. So I think we were understanding, that she was like sexually abused and that is what triggered her kind of disgust at puberty and sexuality and all that.
Mm-hmm. Which is not to say that that's always what happens when somebody is abused, but it could be an explanation.
Right. This seems to twist it a little bit. So this, the way I interpreted what we're supposed to take away from this interaction is that Mrs. Coulter was raised in a like a very strict religious house that sort of beat these very damaging ideas about religion into her, and she was physically abused. And then it was kind of a very straightforward, I was raised by very intense fundamentalist parents and suffered physical abuse and emotional abuse and all that from them. And I only really know how to pursue this rigid moral.
Right. And how to, and how idea. To be disgusted at the idea of knowledge and free will and lust and all the things that come with us. And she just sort of took it to the further extreme.
Right. And so when you're faced with a daughter like Lyra, who is the opposite of that, who is so
curious,
free and curious. And like wild and just pursues her own idea of what's right and wrong.
Yeah. A couple other key things. At the end of this, Mrs. Coulter's shaken. Like she actually holds her demon's hand, which I'm so mad at this show for making me like the monkey. I'm mad at you. Writers, I'm angry. I didn't want to like the monkey. I like the monkey. I feel bad for the monkey. I want the monkey to succeed. This is terrible. It's terrible.
It is the most, the monkey is probably the most different character from the books.
But also very the same. If you apply the things that we're seeing on screen in their interactions to the things you see him do in the books, you could see it this way. I need to like reread it. But the monkey is being given so much context in this series, and I'm here for it. I'm so mad. I'm supposed to hate the monkey. It's supposed to be very clear hatred.
Yeah, the monkey in the books is just all bad.
All bad.
It's like, it's a pure
also,
darkness.
She's worse. Mrs. Coulter is worse.
Oh, she's way worse. Way worse. She doesn't care about her daughter.
I prefer a villain that has more nuance. Even though I will say that Mrs. Coulter in the books is one of the best villains that's ever been written, period. But I think we're going to feel more for her as her arc completes. I will say that the overacting critiques that we've been making, I still feel there are moments of too much.
I'm probably still on book Mrs. Coulter, but I hear what you're saying. And I think this character is increasingly a really compelling
character. It's different. Book Mrs. Coulter is one of the best written characters of all time. She's like Snape. She's like that level of good.
And I was really worried when I saw that we were going to get an emotional Lee Scoresby, Mrs. Coulter scene, because I was like, this is going to be the most overacted, ridiculous, trite thing. And it wasn't.
It wasn't.
Really wasn't.
Had moments.
It had moments. Yeah, totally. If they just did like one more draft of Lee's dialogue that just rolled back a little bit more of the stylistic stuff, I think it would just been a little bit better.
It's good. I was happy for it in the end. Also very happy for Hester pressing her face against Lee. That's a key book, because you can't have Lee's internal monologue saying she never did this. What you have to have is her doing it in a really rare moment. That's the way you show that she only does this here and again.
Yeah.
That's a really key reference that I'm really glad they did.
Melissa, you know what I hate?
I know lots of things that you hate. You're going to have to be a little bit more specific.
I'm not talking about season one of His Dark Materials.
No, don't do that. Because
I didn't hate it. That's why. But one thing I do kind of get annoyed by is you go to your local liquor store, you go to your local bodega, and it's the same beers week after week. You know me, I really like craft beers.
I do.
Pretentious, fancy, unusual beers.
Y'all, he's so pretentious about his craft beer. It's I've learned a lot. I now know what an IPA is, right, which I suppose is the basics.
Yeah. Well, for someone who can't really drink beer, that's not bad.
That's fair.
So I have always been at kind of a loss as to like where to find really interesting beers. Local places all tend to have kind of the same stuff. But then I learned about Tavor.
Yes.
Tavor is an app that actually lets you buy some of the coolest, most interesting beer in the world right from your phone.
Tavor is an app that works with independent craftspeople around the world. You can download the app today and try it for yourself. Just use code extraneous at checkout for $10 off after your first order of $25 or more. All right, so the rest of the pieces of this episode are all going to sort of intersect. So we're going to go back to the beginning of the episode. Lyra is getting her stuff together and getting out of Dodge to go see Mary, but she's not telling Will. She's creeping on out of Chitagate. But first, she opens a trap door and looks at Will, who for some reason in a house full of beds is sleeping on the floor.
That's a little weird. We still don't know why he did that. No. I guess it just sets up the shot. Yeah, so Will has a dream about the knife.
the way the dream is shot, it's like John Parry's words from his interviews are kind of mushed together so that you hear him say the words truly epic letters. So it's sort of pushing Will toward the letters. And then you hear his mother saying, you're going to take up his mantle. So these are all just, they're just trying to clue us into what Will's arc is going to be. So he wakes up and he starts going through the letters and he realizes that they need to ask the alethiometer thing, which the reason I love this is because if I was 14 and had the alethiometer in my possession, I'd be up with it all night asking it everything. Why don't they ask it everything? Sit and ask it the mysteries of the universe, which I know Lyra says means it won't work. But how do you not like immediately sit with the alethiometer and ask it everything you need for your mission?
Yeah, totally. So Lyra and Pan go out to see Mary Malone.
Point of order.
Yeah.
And this is something I never realized in the book either. Lyra and Will go through this window quite a few times after Will has the knife. He's taught to close windows. Why doesn't he close this one? Obviously, the answer is because you need Mary Malone to go through it. Like, you need the window.
Right.
But it's a little bit of a little tiny bit of a plot hole.
Oh, my God. It's a huge plot hole.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, the one thing is maybe he is not sure if this applies to holes that he himself didn't open, but...
No, I think he's smart enough to know that he's the bearer. So he is.
Yeah.
He has opened every single... You know, essentially.
Right. Yeah. Huge question here. Huge question.
I can't believe I never noticed that. Close the window, Will.
Close the window.
Anyway. So as Lyra heads out to London, we get a little bit of shot of Mary Malone trying to figure things out. She's got notes. They're very simple.
Yeah. They're very like movie notes. It's like, do physics? Like, yeah, it's kind of funny. So she walks into her office and this D.I. Walters guy is there. Not a great actor, this guy, I have to say. He's a little...
It's a little much. He's playing it totally chill. We heard a child was running around unsupervised in St. Peter's College. Oh, no. Call the cops. There is a child at a school. What? Nobody believes you, D.I. Walters. He's standing there like arms closed, arms crossed, puffed up in the middle. Like, God.
Yeah, so Lyra shows up and Mary like pulls her aside, but they get caught by this Walters guy. Mm-hmm. And Lyra immediately turns on the charm. She's like, I think she's thinking like, I've gotten through so many of these like adults, so to speak. This one's going to be easy. And I think she kind of is overconfident and she's not like locked into her like telling lies. And she gets beat, basically.
Does Lyra
she takes an L.
Man, what this whole couple of minutes for her is a big L. She has to run. She's like trying to pretend she's staying with friends, and it's a good job by Daphne Keene being a child who's acting badly.
Oh yeah,
like
yeah.
She's a bad actress,
which always I feel like must be really hard for actors to act badly.
Yes, she's like not pulling this off well, and so when he says, you know, is Will at this house too? She goes, oh yes, and then she realizes that she's recognized Will's existence, so she runs, or Mary encourages her to run. Hmm. And when D.I. Walters realizes she's running, he runs out of the room. He pushes over this like classic nerdy girl who's walking through the hallways with her thing of books. He like pushes this chick to the ground. And it's a lot.
So Lyra and Pan are running away, and Pan does his thing that I love, where he turns into a bird and he like goes above the streets and he like directs Lyra to like,
and she like opens her bag and says, Pan, I need help.
Yeah.
And they have this little routine worked out. Again, it's something that they didn't quite do in season one. I don't think they really did this.
Not the same way. No, but you get the sense that like, this is something that they would do like when she was growing up in Oxford to like get away or chase somebody or something.
Totally.
They have this whole routine down. And so Lyra manages to lose mustache guy. And then rolling up in his Tesla.
A Tesla. He's got a Tesla.
He has a Tesla.
Boreal really, really likes this world in this iteration.
He loves it. He's doing great. Yeah. We'll get to this in future episodes. I almost feel a little bit bad for Boreal.
Same. So Pan doesn't get into the car. She jumps in the car with Boreal because the guy's following her, but Pan doesn't get into it. And like the tension I feel, even though I know that Lyra has to live, the tension I feel about her demon being locked out of a car that she's in, it really just like ratcheted it up.
the logistically, he couldn't come into the car because then he would hide in the bag. But if he was in the bag, then Lyra wouldn't have gotten out without the bag.
Right.
And you get the sense that they storyboarded this a few different ways. And
it's like, this is what we make it work. Yeah. Yeah. It's good. It's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it works. And right, like you said, there's like that extra tension of like, if he goes too fast, she's going to die.
She's going to die.
Does he know that?
And I mean, he does, but, you know, he doesn't know if her demon is like in her pocket.
Right.
You know?
Also, she doesn't know that he knows.
He doesn't know that he knows.
Yeah.
It's very confusing.
Yeah. He steals the lithiometer. He's like, she just takes L after L.
L after L. Lyra is just... She's not used to this.
She's not used to it. Mm-mm. Yeah. I mean, she, think about what she did to Mrs. Coulter and Yofer and, you know, the people that she's overcome.
So, meanwhile, we go back to Will and he has this
mustache.
Au revoir. He has this interaction with Angelica, which is a whole, there's an ad. Again, this is new. It's a kind of nice interaction. First of all, Bella Ramsey, great actress.
She is good.
Yeah. She's compelling.
Yeah.
She's natural. She's fierce. She's little Liana Mormont.
Yeah, she has that fierceness to her. Mm-hmm. And she has like a gravity to her performance.
And Will follows her because she's wearing an outfit similar to Lyra. So he thinks it's Lyra. So he follows her. And they have this conversation because he sees her looking through a window. She's looking at Tullio, her brother. And he's like, what are you looking at? And she says, oh, nothing, nothing. And he says, oh, there's a person in the tower.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so Angelica says there's no way in, there's no way out. And she gives this kind of lore dump about the if I want to say it in true Italian, I'm going to fuck it up now because I've said I was going to say it. Torre degli Angeli is how you say it in Italian. You're smiling.
I'm going to leave you.
It means Tower of the Angels. Also, this whole place is in Italian. The shops are in Italian. The names of things are in Italian. They say things in anglicized Italian, but they all have British accents, and it's very weird.
It's like Chernobyl. They're all just cast Brits.
They're just... Anyway, so she gives him all this info about the guild, because, and this is good, because when you see Giacomo, you don't want him to have to lore dump for too long. And he says he's not afraid of the specters. And she says, that's because you've never seen them at work. Mm. She tells Will, you need a plan. You're going to change soon. They're going to come get you.
Yeah.
We were worried that they would just be able to see the specters, but it seems clear that they can't.
Yeah. That's kind of it for Will and
Angelica. But are you down for this humanization?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I am. I think it's great. I think for a lesser actor than Bella Ramsey, I think it would have been a bit like, why are we spending time on it?
Right.
But I think that she is so compelling that instead there is pleasure in just watching her have this interaction.
Totally.
And it's a little foreshadowing for next episode. It's a little bit of a filler scene. Like you could cut it and not really lose anything to the coherence of the story.
Right.
But I thought it was a real pleasure to watch. And it will also, I think, going forward, add a little weight to subsequent events like the choices that Will is making,
right?
Because, you know, there will be human costs and he is a little more aware of that.
Totally. So Will goes back and tries to find Lyra, looking around, sees the note, goes to the portal where she is sitting outside on a different bench, crying, like sobbing.
Still the Botanic Gardens, right?
No, that's not the Botanic Garden.
It's next to the window.
Exactly. Right? Right next to the window. They're in like inside the gate, but before the window.
Right. Hornbeam trees.
Hornbeam trees.
Yeah.
So she is sitting out there crying and she spills to Will what has happened, that she lost the lithiometer, and they have to, and they figure out that Boreal gave her his card, his antiquarian card.
Right.
And that they have to go Charles Lattram, they have to go and talk to him.
So this scene in the books, it was one of those scenes that I remember I really bumped on, because it's one of those Wills like, well, why were you doing something other than helping me? Like, how dare you?
Right.
Like, you've done something very unethical and you deserve to lose. And it's like, it kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And it's part of Philip Pullman's like at times kind of foreign, weird moral world this is situated in. Mm-hmm. They don't really attempt that here. And I appreciate it. First of all, because the Will in this TV series is so different.
Yeah.
You know? That if he suddenly started bossing Lyra around and like telling her she was like, she made a moral. Yeah.
He does try to boss around a little, but like in a very warm and caring way.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was interesting that they're setting aside some of Will's more autocratic moments in the book, which, you know,
his autocratic tendencies.
Yeah, he does kind of have those. Like, this is what's right. This is what we need to do.
So they have to hide for a while. So they go to the movies. Lyra has this very cute moment where she can't stop eating popcorn. She's like, I hate it. It tastes like wood shavings. It's like, so stop eating it. They have this little fight. She says, just because I'm not sat in a corner crying doesn't mean I don't take things seriously, which is funny because he did find her sat in a corner crying. But they sort of bump against this, like, your Will has this charge that you're just messing about. You're not doing anything important. And she's like, I am. And she opens up to him about Roger while she rage eats popcorn. Talks to him about the friend that she lost that her father killed.
Yeah.
And he admits that he was worried about her, and it's, you can just see it all starting to happen. They're already starting to fall for each other.
Yeah.
It's very lovely. And then they're in a John Hughes movie, as you said.
Yeah, it's so straight out of a John Hughes movie. And they're watching Paddington 2.
Yeah.
Or Paddington 1.
I don't know.
I honestly don't know. But my favorite part of the scene is Pan is so into the movie. He pokes his little head out. Mm-hmm. He's like just watching it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's about somebody who goes into another world.
Right.
Which is lovely. And you can just see her face. They don't dwell on it. She doesn't talk about it later. Mm-hmm. But and then Will is sitting there on his phone, which is great. I love the modernization of that he can use his phone. He needs to buy several backup chargers. Quick little piece on Mary Malone. We meet her family?
Yeah. Again, like completely not in the book. Totally just
she's a
made
loner
up.
Loner in the book. This is completely made up. So yeah, her family comes over and is they're trying to point out how devoted she is to work. And,
right, yeah. And she works too much. She's she's like, it's like rom-com stuff.
Her sister reads her mail. So what is she doing? Stop reading her mail. She's a really good aunt.
I have a job. I don't have time for a man. Right. I don't have time for love. Like all those TikToks.
I don't have time for God. What is this? It's like God's rom-com.
Yeah.
But they do show her trying to use the I Ching, which, write to us. Have you ever done I Ching? I don't know. I don't know anything about this.
I also don't. I haven't got around to Googling it, so I don't. It's completely foreign to me.
What they seem to be zoning in on is that the alethiometer is not the only way to access truth about the universe, and that it's through this negative space capability, this negative capability thing that that Lyra does with the alethiometer, and they're showing that Mary Malone can do it too. So whatever she's doing, it's important. So she does the I Ching and interprets it, and it says, to the mind that is still, the whole universe surrenders. And so it's like keeps pointing out to her that this is important to open yourself up to, like, wisdom and knowledge and whatnot.
Yeah. Just want to point out, because I think everyone, at least America, is watching it, I feel like we have another great recent example of this negative capability staked. Beth in The Queen's Gambit.
Yes.
It's in like extremely this.
100%.
Yeah.
She goes to a place when in her big games where she really, it's the zone. It's when you're, it's just the zone. Mm-hmm. When you're working on something and you get into the zone, that's what this is. What's his name? David Lynch would love this.
Oh, yeah.
This is some transcendental meditation.
This is big time.
Yeah. Accessing the secrets of the universe.
Mm-hmm. Man. Like when he's throwing the rocks, the Tibetan thing of hold the question in your mind and throw a rock and see if it.
For a treat, if you have Masterclass, watch David Lynch's stuff, because he's all like, yeah, I'll talk about film, blah, blah, blah. And he seems to be fine talking about film. And then at the end, it's like somebody told him that he could do a thing on transcendental meditation, and he's the happiest he's ever been in his life.
Oh, clearly that's the only way they got him to do it. It's like, just talk about something film related for like an hour, and then you can talk about transcendental meditation. It's he's like, okay, I will.
Oh my God, that was a really good impression. All right, so last scene. We go to Boreal's house.
We get some L'Oreal from the curatorial Boreal.
He's a curatorial Boreal.
Yeah,
wearing clothing choices sartorial.
Athleisureal.
He's in athleisureal. So yeah, they show up and say that they're Lizzie and Mark.
Turns out he will give them the lithiometer, allegedly, if they bring him the knife.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
I was like, well, I love that they made sure that Lyra would be a lunatic in this scene.
She throws wonderful. One of his like Tiffany crystals.
Yeah, she just crashes it. He does reveal who she is, but she never had like a moment of like, I think I know who this guy is. But it like, he does kind of, he mentions Mrs. Coulter and the light bulb goes off. He's like, now she remembers. And she gets mad and she's throwing things and Will's trying to stop her. It's definitely exactly what it's like in the book, which I appreciate. Yeah. And not just because it's from the book, but because it is a very true to their characters moment. So I'm very glad about that.
And it ends with this kind of stare down with Lyra saying, "We'll get your knife."
All right. Well, I think it's time for us to do a quick extra award.
Extra awards. I agree.
Who are you going for?
I'm going with Scarlett O'Hara. The barmaid with the spider demon. Ugh. Can you imagine like being 14 or whatever and waking up and being like, oh, it's a giant spider? Really? Yeah. Is that who I am?
Are we the bad guys?
Am I the bad guy?
I have a spider demon. It's the color of blood.
Should I just lean in?
Just lean into it.
Dye my hair to match my spider.
Oh my God. Who is my extra award? I believe. Oh, I'm going John Perry.
Cool.
With his whole
Return.
I'll put up my hood. I have tattoos on my fingers and I'm just going to say things in a cool voice. Ah. He's like speaking Parseltongue. Try and get
totally.
Him back.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yep. Speaking to the winds.
Happy holiday season.
The amorphous holiday season.
If you're listening to this on the first week of December, remember that you can get a lot of cool gifts for your friends at mischiefmerch.com.
That's for sure.
Use the code THANKFUL on any order over $25 to get free shipping.
That is cool.
Anything else they can get for people?
Yeah, they can get a membership to our GD Patreon.
GD Patreon.
Guys, the Mischief Management Patreon is so cool. It is, first of all, it covers the entire Mischief Media Empire.
World. Yeah. Empire. Taking over.
So it's all the podcasts. It's all the people that you know from the events and the merch and the whole shindig. There are extra episodes on there. There's artwork. There are essays. There are articles. There are other stuff. And if you join the Patreon, you get access to an exclusive Discord with all the Mischief people, all the podcasters, a good chunk of the Mischief Media community. It's active about podcast stuff. It's active about other stuff, Animal Crossing, Broadway, Animal Crossing, other stuff, Animal Crossing. So check it out, patreon.com/makingmischief. And while you're at it, you can.
You just said it.
Hey, stay extra. We'll see you next week.
Bye.